Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing improving Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health outcomes and the Indigenous Voice to Parliament referendum. My special guest is Professor Ian Anderson, who is the Deputy Vice-Chancellor Academic at the University of Tasmania. He trained as a medical doctor and was one of the first Indigenous Australians to be appointed as Deputy Vice-Chancellor of an Australian university. Professor Anderson has also served as Deputy Secretary in the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet and the Deputy Chief Executive Officer of the National Indigenous Australians Agency. Professor Anderson, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Professor Anderson, how do you see the state of Indigenous well-being and health at the moment in Australia?
So I might start by talking about the key things that have shaped this answer. So I'm Palawa. I'm the first Palawa graduate in medicine, and I'm a public health physician. I also was very privileged working for the Australian government in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet to lead the conversation that led to the latest round of conversations around Closer Gap. So I have a very privileged experience of leading change in Indigenous health, both from being a practitioner, an Aboriginal health worker and a doctor, but also as a policy leader in Indigenous health and Indigenous affairs. So there are a couple of things that I think are profoundly important to acknowledge. One is that the Aboriginal world, Aboriginal health status in the world that I was growing up to was quite poor. People were unable to access healthcare. These are in the days before we had Medicare and we had universal access to healthcare. When Aboriginal people accessed healthcare, really depending on the philanthropy of a doctor. Now that world has long gone. And the world that has replaced it has built a very sophisticated set of Aboriginal-led services, commonly called the Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Services. And they have really reshaped Aboriginal experience of healthcare, but also influenced change in the non-Indigenous health world. So about 50% of the Indigenous population today will get a significant proportion of their care through an Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Service, and the other 50% will use private general practice as their primary way of getting healthcare. So it is a world that is substantially much improved in terms of healthcare provision for Indigenous Australians. There's also been some significant improvements in Aboriginal life expectancy and key areas of mortality in the last 30 years. So we're not starting today from ground zero. We're actually starting to continue to build improve outcomes for Indigenous health. One of the things I would further observe is that those aspects of health that are amenable to high quality primary care are much better today than they were 30 or 40 years ago. So for example, diabetes care is much better. Most areas of chronic disease care is much better. But there are still things that are continuing to be very troubling, for example, cancer care. So there are areas of Indigenous health that have improved. There are areas which continue to trouble us. And there are areas which I think will require further action. And they go to action in relation to the social determinants of health, improved housing, improved education, improvements in participation in the economy. So there's much work to be done. The second thing that I was actually alluding to is actually these improvements have substantially been driven by Aboriginal voices, Aboriginal perspectives on how you improve healthcare. In the 70s and 1980s, that was very much from the community controlled health services that were set up in a number of cities across Australia, but increasingly it's also from Aboriginal trained doctors, Aboriginal health workers, Aboriginal nurses who are bringing in another set of experiences that are really critical to further improvements in healthcare. But none of this could actually happen without kind of really sustained engagement with those Aboriginal voices, both at a local and regional level, but also at a national level.
And how important is it for Aboriginal health initiatives to be self-led, a concept that really displayed positive results during the COVID pandemic?
It's absolutely true. And so Aboriginal leadership is not a silver bullet, but it is absolutely fundamental to change. So can I give two examples over recent years? One is the more recent example of COVID-19 across Australia. So a recent review has shown that the number of Aboriginal cases was significantly less by a factor of 6 over the period of the pandemic compared to non-Indigenous cases. Now, that was primarily because there was an early response where the Federal Department of Health worked very closely with the Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Services and other stakeholders and other experts to ensure that the response was both achievable and fast. This particularly was key to providing solutions in remote Australia, was key to ensuring that that services were well prepared to provide advice to Indigenous communities about how to prevent COVID-19, and also ensuring that this was occurring both on the ground, so local service providers, but also national experts were key to driving that really effect. And that was an impressive response. And it was very different to other countries. So in the United States, for example, of America, the experience for Native Americans was substantially different. In fact, you saw much poorer outcomes for Native Americans, particularly in the Navajo Nation, where rates of mortality were substantially higher than non-Indigenous colleagues. So I think Australia can be justly proud to working well with Indigenous Australians to get the COVID-19 response home. That's not the only example that comes to mind. I know that, for example, in Alice Springs, there was a recent problem where alcohol control mechanisms were substantially relaxed following the end of, after a period of 10 years. And the Community Controlled Health Services in Alice Springs, the local service providers, said to both the NT government and the Commonwealth government, do not do this. Do not do this, because if you make alcohol much more available in our communities, there will be an upswing in violence, there will be an upswing in all the kind of negative consequences of freer access to alcohol. That happened. And then the NT government and the Commonwealth government had to work very quickly to rectify that. Now, they could have avoided that problem if they had engaged early and talked to the local experts, particularly the Indigenous services in Alice Springs. So there are a number of examples which I could point to where actually you get better service responses if you work with the communities that are going to be affected by the services.
And let's talk about local health services. Do you believe enough is being done at a local health service level to help improve health outcomes for Aboriginal people?
It varies across Australia, the extent to which this happens, and varies in different communities. So it's probably not meaningful to generalise, but I think what I'm saying is that the more you do this, the more you work with the communities that you want to affect change in, the better your outcomes. Now, it's not a bullet, it's not a silver bullet. That doesn't mean that you can't make mistakes, but you build that into your learning. You build that into ways in which you go back to community and say, look, that didn't seem to work. Any other ideas about what we might do together? But the point is that in no parts of Australia, in the Australian community, where you would not want to work with communities in trying to find solutions to any tricky health issues. It's the same in migrant communities, it's the same in poor communities, it's the same across Australia. The challenge is to make sure we do this far more consistently with the Indigenous communities in Australia. And we do it both locally, but also do it nationally. And we do it in to ensure that national policy kind of recognises the need to have Indigenous expertise on the ground helping shape policy. So when we worked the Close the Gap Agreement, rather than in 2008, where you had the Commonwealth Government working with all the state governments and territories, this time we work with the Coalition of Aboriginal Peak Organisations, who are peak organisations that represented service delivery organisations across all fields, in health, in education, housing, justice, etc. So and they had a decision-making role. They weren't just being consulted. They were drafting the agreement with the Commonwealth Government and the state governments, and not surprisingly, got a better outcome. The agreement was much better than if it had just been the Commonwealth working with state governments.
You served as Deputy Secretary in the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet in Canberra. How unique was that experience for you? And secondly, what is the divide in knowledge between what's happening on the ground and what's happening in Canberra in terms of Indigenous health?
Firstly, that was a unique experience of being working in government to lead such an important set of reforms. But it wasn't completely unique, and nor is it going to be unusual in the future. You will have an increasing number of Indigenous Australians who've got that on-the-ground experience leading policy reform in government, and you want that. It's not enough, and that's the fundamental point. You can have really top, well-educated, highly attuned, sharp bureaucrats. It's not enough. The problem is particularly for example, the Close the Gap Agreement, is that you work for a government. And you need additional voices at the table that actually reshape the government perspective. And that's particularly what I saw in working on the Close the Gap Agreement. I represented the Prime Minister. I represented the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. They had a view about what a good agreement might look like. The Coalition of Peaks didn't represent the government. They had a different view. And my job as a negotiator was to actually find a shared ground in between the different perspectives. So I actually relied on the Coalition of Peaks in some ways to push me further than my government would allow me to push. Yeah, and it's also true of why just having Aboriginal people in the parliament is not enough. In the parliament, you can provide an Indigenous perspective, and that can be a powerful driver for change, but you also live in a party, and that party has policy positions. So if you really want to change the dynamic, you've got to create another mechanism to drive change, and that's at the heart of the idea of between the voices of parliament, is that you have another mechanism coming in that actually puts the pressure on the right points in the system to get better outcomes, both in terms of policy design, program design, and outcomes.
And how important would a structure like the Voice to Parliament be in terms of affecting change, real change on the ground for Aboriginal health and wellbeing outcomes?
So if we go back a step, why would we have a Voice to Parliament that's enshrined in the Constitution? So the fundamental reason for that is that governments don't like advice all the time. There have been times when governments have not liked the advice that Indigenous advisory mechanisms have provided, and they've shut them down, or they've buried that advice in reports. So the idea of a constitutional enshrinement is to say that governments, you cannot do that. You don't have to follow that advice. You have the right to ignore that advice, and the Parliament is supreme, but you cannot avoid taking advice. That's happened a number of times in recent history. there was a structure called the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission. It was shut down in 2004. There were a number of reasons why it was shut down, but the clearest reason was that it was suggesting that to the government at the time that they should start to talk about treaties and Aboriginal treaties. Then it was closed in 2004, and there's been a kind of large gap in the provision of structured advice to governments. The other thing I'd say is that there are many bodies that actually do provide advice to government. The AMA is one. The professional bodies are another. Business bodies, such as Business Council of Australia. But they are independently able to resource themselves, whereas Indigenous Australia is still relatively poor and cannot provide the resources without economic development to provide advice to government in the same way that's independent of government. So the question you're asking is, how can it play a role in relationship to Indigenous health outcomes? What it can play a role to, I would recommend that a future, if a voice to Parliament is created, that it has got the power to provide advice on issues that matter to Indigenous Australians and not wait to be asked. That's also quite important. And that's how most advice works, is government consults, government goes to people, say, we want advice on X, and people say, well, actually, that's important, but what about issue number five? That's also important. So having a voice to Parliament gives Aboriginal people the power to provide advice on issues that matter to them. So I think that it's sort of, and it covers all areas of outcomes. If we want to improve, going back to what I was saying before, improving quality of healthcare, the voice to Parliament at both the regional level and also a national level should provide advice on what that might look at. If there is reforms to the Medicare system and the voice to Parliament mechanism believes that it has a direct impact on Indigenous outcomes, they should provide advice on how to make sure it delivers better outcomes for Indigenous Australians. If there is legislation in front of the Parliament that goes to cultural heritage matters, I would suggest that a voice to the Parliament should actually advise on the outcomes and the impact on Indigenous Australians. So I think it's important that it's not just health issues, it's across all the determinants of health. It's around employment, it's around education, it's around housing, it's around issues in remote Australia, it's around issues in urban Australia. So the ability to provide advice that impacts on Indigenous lives is really important to improving health outcome, whether it's about health issues, health services, or the broader cultural and social determinants of health.
And you talk about governments only seeking feedback when they want it, and government seeks feedback on one topic at once because consultations are run by individual departments. But a voice to Parliament would reach across those individual consultations.
It's structured by the structure of government. So that there is important work happening in conservation and conservation management. Government actually doesn't see that it connects to health. It's up to the voice to Parliament to make that connection for government. If there is legislation in the Parliament in relationship to changes to employment services, it's up to the voice to Parliament to make the connection with health. Governments won't make that connection necessarily. So I think that's pretty key to ensuring that a focus around health is at the front of most of the issues that the voice will consider, even though it may be directly about health or health issues.
A last question for you. We're talking about the 2023 referendum, but if I can take you back to the referendum of 1967, and your PhD, I believe, focused on the development of Indigenous health policy after that referendum. Can you talk to me and give me a snapshot at a high level about what are some of the key findings from your PhD that still hold true today?
So well done on your research. There are a couple of things that are absolutely pivotal that I learned from that PhD process. One is that the 1967 referendum made possible a Commonwealth response on Aboriginal health. Up until that point, the Commonwealth arguably could not pass legislation on Aboriginal people, for Aboriginal people, on Indigenous issues. It was precluded from doing so in the original constitution. It's also to the original constitution did not allow the Commonwealth to collect population data on Indigenous people. Without population data, you can't have health outcome data. There are a number of kind of things that were impossible to do prior to 1967, and one is for the Commonwealth to run an Indigenous health program, and the second is to actually collect stats that actually understood what the status was in Indigenous health. So that changed post-referendum, and then the Commonwealth very slowly took control of its newfound powers. It set up funding for Indigenous health. It started to fund Indigenous community-controlled health services, but initially funded to a greater extent state government services, but tipped towards funding proportionally a higher number of Indigenous-led programs. It also gave the possibility to frame its approach according to government policy of the day around self-determination. So to a certain extent, it provided the mechanisms that enabled really to provide access to healthcare for Indigenous Australians. The other thing that that people probably are not aware of is that prior to the 1967 referendum, the Commonwealth, on the basis of its understanding of its constitutional powers, excluded Indigenous Australians, variously defined, from all social welfare. From all sides. So and Australia led the world in innovation in terms of social welfare, from the Unemployment Act, unemployment benefits, from invalid pensions, from other early childhood. Most of those were not available to Indigenous Australians, which created a system of racial rationing of social welfare that is actually very similar to how the apartheid system worked in South Africa. And the other thing that probably people are unaware of is that this didn't require constitutional reform, is that Aboriginal people were not able to vote. Aboriginal people were not able to vote in most state government elections. In fact, when Australia federated, Aboriginal people were taken off the electoral roll in South Australia and not able to vote in Commonwealth elections until the first set of reforms were in 1949, when returned soldiers were allowed to vote. And then in 1962, all Aboriginal people were able to vote in a Commonwealth election. And then in 1984, Aboriginal people were able to vote on the same basis as other Australians. So there were kind of very complex set of social welfare reforms, voting reforms that also mirrored some of the intent of the constitutional referendum of 1967.
Professor Anderson, thank you so much for joining me today.
I could go on more about. Thank you.
My special guest has been Professor Ian Anderson, who is the Deputy Vice-Chancellor Academic at the University of Tasmania. He trained as a medical doctor and was the first Indigenous Australian to be appointed as Deputy Vice-Chancellor of an Australian university. You can find more podcasts on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.